Disc 15. Eliza Hamilton remembered the sleepless night when her husband gave immortal expression to a durable principle of constitutional law. As an ancient lady garbed in widow's weeds, she told the story to a young man who recorded it this way in his journal. Old Mrs. Hamilton, active in body, clear in mind, talks familiarly of Washington, Jefferson, and the fathers. I told her how greatly I was interested on account of her husband's connection with the government. "He made your government," said she. "He made your bank. I sat up all night with him to help him do it. Jefferson thought we ought not to have a bank, and President Washington thought so. But my husband said we must have a bank. I sat up all night, copied out his writing, and the next morning he carried it to President Washington, and we had a bank." Hamilton's own allusion to staying up the greatest part of that night also attests to some electrifying finish, some final brilliant burst of inspiration that completed his stupendous feat. As with many of his intellectual exploits, they were almost feats of athletic prowess as well. Hamilton lent his opinion the erudition of a treatise and the warmth of a manifesto. The essence of it was that government must possess the means to attain ends for which it was established, or the bonds of society would dissolve. To liberate the government from a restrictive reading of the Constitution, Hamilton refined the doctrine of implied powers, that is, that the government had the right to employ all means necessary to carry out powers mentioned in the Constitution. In drafting his opinion, Hamilton claimed that minutes of the Constitutional Convention could provide ample confirmation of his liberal interpretation of the necessary and proper clause. Reluctant to break the convention's confidentiality oath, or perhaps afraid that Madison might play the same game, he then expunged the passage and let the Constitution speak for itself. He told Washington that if adopted, principles of construction like those espoused by the Secretary of State and the Attorney General would be fatal to the just and indispensable authority of the United States. Then, in blazing italics, Hamilton trumpeted his main theme. "Now it appears to the Secretary of the Treasury that this general principle is inherent in the very definition of government and essential to every step of the progress to be made by that of the United States. Namely, that every power vested in a government is in its nature sovereign and includes by force of the term a right to employ all the means requisite and fairly applicable to the attainment of the ends of such power." If Jefferson's and Randolph's views were upheld, the United States would furnish the singular spectacle of a political society without sovereignty, or of a people governed without government. Hamilton waved away complaints that the Constitution did not explicitly mention a bank. It is not denied that there are implied as well as express powers, and that the former are as effectually delegated as the latter. To argue, as did Jefferson, that all government policies had to pass a strict test of being absolutely necessary to the performance of specified duties would paralyze government. How could one say with certainty what was absolutely necessary? Hamilton pointed out that in setting up the customs service, he had overseen construction of lighthouses, beacons, and buoys, things not strictly necessary, but useful for society all the same. He was crafting a rationale for the future exercise of numerous forms of federal power. The Bank of the United States would enable the government to make good on four powers cited explicitly in the Constitution: the rights to collect taxes, borrow money, regulate trade among states, and support fleets and armies. Jefferson wanted to deprive the federal government of the power to create any corporations, which Hamilton thought could cripple American business in the future. At the time, few corporations existed, and those mostly to build turnpikes. The far-seeing Hamilton perceived the immense utility of this business form and patiently explained to Washington how corporations with limited liability were superior to private partnerships. In the end, his bank argument was predicated not only on his interpretation of the Constitution, but on his reading of history. In all questions of this nature, the practice of mankind ought to have great weight against the theories of individuals. After writing this magisterial defense, Hamilton packed it off to Washington by noon on Wednesday, February 23rd. The next day, Washington studied the opinion and, despite lingering doubts, was sufficiently impressed that he did not bother to send it to Jefferson. The day after that, he signed the bank bill. Hamilton's plea for the bank had a continuing life in American history, partly from the influence it exerted upon Chief Justice John Marshall. When Daniel Webster made oral arguments for the Second Bank of the United States in the landmark case of McCulloch v. Maryland in 1819, he quoted Hamilton's 1791 memo to Washington on the Necessary and Proper Clause. In words that distinctly echoed Hamilton's, Marshall said that necessary didn't mean indispensable so much as appropriate. Repeatedly in American history, Hamilton's flexible definition of the word necessary was to free government to handle unforeseen emergencies. Henry Cabot Lodge later referred to the doctrine of implied powers enunciated by Hamilton as the most formidable weapon in the armory of the Constitution, capable of conferring on the federal government powers of almost any extent. Hamilton was not the master builder of the Constitution. The laurels surely go to James Madison. He was, however, its foremost interpreter, starting with the Federalist and continuing with his Treasury tenure, where he had to expound constitutional doctrines to accomplish his goals. He lived, in theory and practice, every syllable of the Constitution. For that reason, Clinton Rossiter insisted that Hamilton's works and words have been more consequential than those of any other American in shaping the Constitution under which we live. Among many arcane subjects that Hamilton had to master was the minting of coins. So laggard was America in this regard that after Washington took office, his daily expenses were still quoted in British pounds, shillings, and pence, even though the Confederation Congress had adopted the dollar as the currency unit. Businessmen in different states continued to assign differing values to the foreign coins that still circulated freely. So many gold and silver coins were adulterated with base metals that many merchants hesitated to do business for fear of being shortchanged. Counterfeiting was also widespread, and when Hamilton became Treasury Secretary, it was still a crime punishable by death in New York State. Somehow, even as he brought forth his bank report, Hamilton plowed through books about coinage in foreign nations, especially Principles of Political Economy by Sir James Stuart. He pored over tables that Isaac Newton, as Master of the Mint, had prepared for the British Treasury Board, specifying the pound's exact value in precious metals, and he ordered special assays of foreign coins to gauge the gold, silver, and copper content in their alloys. On January 28, 1791, a week after the Senate approved his bank bill, Hamilton handed beleaguered legislators yet another hefty document. His report on the mint was studded with clever suggestions. There is scarcely any point in the economy of national affairs of greater moment than the uniform preservation of the intrinsic value of the money unit, he intoned. On this, the security and steady value of property essentially depend. He endorsed the dollar as the basic currency, divided into smaller coins on a decimal basis. Because many Americans still bartered, Hamilton wanted to encourage the use of coins. As part of his campaign to foster a market economy, Hamilton suggested introducing a wide variety of coins, including gold and silver dollars, a 10-cent silver piece, and copper coins of a cent or half cent. He wasn't just thinking of rich people. Small coins would benefit the poor by enabling them to purchase in small portions and at a more reasonable rate the necessaries of which they stand in need. To spur patriotism, he proposed that coins feature presidential heads or other emblematic designs and display great beauty and workmanship. It is a just observation that the perfection of the coins is a great safeguard against counterfeits. With customary attention to detail, Hamilton recommended that coins should be small and thick instead of large and thin, making it more difficult to rub away the metal. As to whether coins should be minted from gold or silver, Hamilton caused no end of mischief by opting for both, starting the vogue for bimetallism that was to become the curse of American financial history. He stumbled into this decision because he feared that if he chose either gold or silver as the sole monetary metal, it would abridge the quantity of circulating medium at a time when his primary aim was to expand the money supply and stoke economic activity. One major problem that he sought to remedy was that the dollar had no fixed value in various states. With typical exactitude, Hamilton tried to establish the quantity of precious metal in each coin, so that the silver dollar, for instance, would contain 370 grains and 933 thousandth parts of a grain of pure silver. At the time Hamilton drafted his report on the mint, he and Jefferson still talked civilly and exchanged ideas about money. Coinage was one of Jefferson's hobby horses, and he had reported on it to Congress the previous summer. In fact, Hamilton drew on that report in preparing his paper. For once, they seemed in agreement. "I return your report on the mint, which I have read over with a great deal of satisfaction," Jefferson told Hamilton before the latter sent it to Congress. While minister in Paris, Jefferson had visited the Royal Mint and marveled at a machine concocted by the Swiss inventor Jean-Pierre Drouot, which could simultaneously stamp images on both sides of a coin. Hamilton long regretted that when the U.S. Mint was finally established by Congress in spring 1792 and began to produce the first federal coins, Washington lodged it under Jefferson's jurisdiction at state. The mint was a pet interest of Jefferson, and Washington submitted to his prodding. The president also believed that the Treasury Secretary was bowed beneath enough work. Unfortunately, Jefferson ran the mint poorly. Hamilton later tried in vain to arrange a swap whereby the post office would go to state in exchange for the mint coming under Treasury control, where it belonged. Despite this wobbly start, the mint became a Philadelphia fixture, and when the government moved to Washington, D.C. in 1800, it stayed behind in the interim capital. That the Bank of the United States had sparked heated controversy and polarized the country must have seemed like forgotten history on July 4, 1791. On that memorable day in Philadelphia, the subscription to the stock of Hamilton's central bank was thrown open to an expectant public, and the public promptly went berserk. Speculation was rife that the stock would pay rich dividends of 12% or more, and people had been flocking to the Capitol for a week in anticipation of this first offering. So lusty was the pent-up demand that mobs, dazzled by visions of riches, stormed the building, overwhelming the clerks. The heavily oversubscribed issue sold out within an hour, leaving many disgruntled investors empty-handed. Jefferson told James Monroe, "The bank filled and overflowed in the moment it was opened." Hamilton had expected an ebullient market in these publicly traded shares, but nothing nearly this clamorous. By late June, reports flooded his office of large quantities of money flowing into the forthcoming subscription. "In all appearances, the subscriptions to the Bank of the United States will proceed with astonishing rapidity," Hamilton assured one congressman. "'Twill not be surprising if a week completes them." Even Hamilton never dreamed that the response would be so giddy that it would take less than an hour to complete the offering. When trading in shares commenced, prices promptly took off, buoyed by a money fever such as Americans had never witnessed. Investors did not purchase shares outright. To create a robust market and broaden share ownership, Hamilton agreed to sell the bank shares initially in the form of scrip. The system worked thus. Investors made a $25 down payment and received a scrip that entitled them to buy a set number of shares at par and then pay off the balance over an 18-month period. So frenzied was the trading in scrip that many investors doubled their money within days, and the resulting madness was dubbed scripomania. The contagion spread rapidly to other cities. Special couriers galloped off to New York to report prices rocketing upward in Philadelphia and Boston, and newspapers recorded each fresh spurt in shares. Madison happened to be in New York and watched with consternation as the trading mania descended on Manhattan. For this Virginia planter, the bedlam of speculation wasn't a pretty sight. On July 10th, he informed Jefferson that the bank shares have risen as much in the market here as at Philadelphia, and castigated the booming market as a mere scramble for so much public plunder. Like Madison, Jefferson didn't view this delirium of speculation as a tribute to Hamilton's mystique so much as squandered money. He told Washington, "It remains to be seen whether in a country whose capital is too small to carry its own commerce, to establish manufactures, erect buildings, etc., such sums should have been withdrawn from these useful pursuits to be employed in gambling." Hamilton had brought the modern financial world to America with all its unsettling effects. He had wanted to spread bank ownership widely, but he made a critical blunder that only ratified Southern suspicions that he was the ringleader of a Northern plot. Philadelphia had hosted the initial offering, and many investors had traveled there, lugging gold and silver to make purchases. Hamilton had also arranged for Bostonians to buy scrip through the Bank of Massachusetts and New Yorkers through the Bank of New York. Hence, a disproportionate number of scrip holders resided in Philadelphia, Boston, and New York, which looked like errant favoritism rather than a consequence of the fact that Boston and New York had banks to act as intermediaries. Hamilton regretted this ownership pattern, and his correspondence confirms that he had written to Southerners, trying to entice them to buy bank shares. The troubling preponderance of Northeast investors combined with other factors to feed the impression of a Northern oligarchy assiduously at work. Most subscribers were merchants and lawyers, whom Hamilton's political following comprised, and some of the most visible speculators, especially William Dewar, belonged to his entourage. With Jefferson and Madison poised to spot British-style corruption in the legislature, it did not help Hamilton's cause that at least 30 members of Congress and Secretary of War Knox subscribed to bank scrip. Hamilton knew that a speculative binge on securities could tarnish his system. He welcomed enthusiasm, but not crazed investors. These extravagant sallies of speculation do injury to the government and to the whole system of public credit, Hamilton had warned earlier in the year. He was never a hireling of moneyed interests. Rather, he wanted to attach them to the new country's interests. Like many thinkers of his day, he thought that property conferred independent judgment on people and hoped that creditors would bring an enlightened, disinterested point of view to government. But what if they succumbed to speculation and disrupted the system they were supposed to stabilize? What if they engaged in destructive short-term behavior instead of being long-term custodians of the nation's interests? If that happened, it might undermine his whole political program. As with any speculative bubble, it is hard to pin down the elusive moment when reasonable confidence in bank scrip bloomed into euphoria. As late as July 31st, Fisher Ames wrote to Hamilton from Boston, praising the bank subscription. "People here are full of exultation and gratitude." Then, in early August, prices soared upward in a vertical line. On August 8th, Madison expressed shock to Jefferson. "The stock jobbers will become the Praetorian head of the government, at once its tool and its tyrant, bribed by its largesses and overawing it by clamors and combinations." Jefferson brooded about the harm to America's moral fiber. "The spirit of gaming, once it has seized a subject, is incurable. The tailor who has made thousands in one day, though he has lost them the next, can never again be content with the slow and moderate earnings of his needle." Benjamin Rush reported the same money-mad bustle in Philadelphia. Everybody from merchants to clerks was forsaking everyday duties to wager on scrip. "The city of Philadelphia for several days has exhibited the marks of a great gaming house. Never did I see so universal a frenzy. Nothing else was spoken of but scrip in all companies, even by those who were not interested in it." Senator Rufus King later told Hamilton that New York City's economy had ground to a halt as people rushed off to gamble in bank shares. "The business was going on in a most alarming manner, mechanics deserting their shops, shopkeepers sending their goods to auction, and not a few of our merchants neglecting the regular and profitable commerce of the city." Finally, on August 11, 1791, came the first crash in government securities in American history. Bank scrip that had gone on sale for $25 just over a month earlier had zoomed to more than $300. The bubble was pricked when bankers refused to extend more credit to leading speculators. Then bears began to sell and shares nosedived. As the chief financial regulator, this market turbulence thrust Hamilton into a ticklish situation. He had no precedents to guide him. As a rule, he tried not to interfere with markets and thought it improper to register opinions on the value of government securities. But he also believed he had an obligation to protect the financial system, and so he improvised as he went along. On August 15th, Rufus King informed Hamilton that speculators attempting to depress bank shares were quoting Hamilton's opinion that scrip was grossly overvalued. "They go further and mention prices below the present market as the value sanctioned by your authority." The rumors had some basis in truth. As Hamilton admitted to King, he did not ordinarily voice opinions about the suitable level of shares, but he had intimated that prices were too high. "I thought it advisable to speak out, for a bubble connected with my operations is, of all the enemies I have to fear, in my judgment, the most formidable. To counteract delusions appears to me the only secure foundation on which to stand. I thought it, therefore, expedient to risk something in contributing to dissolve the charm. In modern lingo, Hamilton subtly tried to talk down the market to avert a worse tumble later on. At the same time, he stressed that the price he had quoted as the proper level for scrip was not as low as the one being bandied about by speculators. On August 16th, Hamilton wrote confidentially to William Seaton, cashier of the Bank of New York, instructing him to buy up $150,000 in government securities, what we would today call open market operations. Hamilton hoped that as these security prices rose, the beneficial effect would spill over into the market for bank shares. His strategy worked. What concerned Hamilton was not so much the harm to speculators as the risk to the financial system. He particularly feared that securities dealers, caught in a cash squeeze, might liquidate shares and precipitate a self-sustaining drop in prices. As he put it, "A principal object with me is to keep the stock from falling too low in case the embarrassments of the dealers should lead to sacrifices." Complicating matters was the uncomfortable fact that the most flamboyant New York speculator was Hamilton's boon companion from King's College days, William Dewar. Dewar had lasted 7 months as assistant treasury secretary. After leaving office, he lost no time in capitalizing on his knowledge of treasury operations and set about cornering state debt, sending teams of buying agents into the boondocks. Dewar borrowed heavily to finance his enormous trading in bank scrip, and Hamilton knew this added extreme danger to the situation. On August 17th, Hamilton wrote a tough-minded letter to Dewar, reproaching him for his maneuvers and invoking the South Sea Bubble of 1720. He told Dewar that people were whispering that he and his associates were rigging the price of bank scrip through fictitious purchases to dupe a gullible public into buying more shares. While adding tactfully that he knew Dewar would do no such duplicitous thing, Hamilton made clear that he took these reports seriously. "I will honestly own I had serious fears for you, for your purse and for your reputation, and with an anxiety for both, I wrote to you in earnest terms." Hamilton's letter showed his usual integrity, displaying both concern for Dewar as a friend and for the health of the securities market. Then Hamilton compromised himself by tipping his hand and suggesting to Dewar an appropriate price for bank stock. "I should rather call it about 190 to be within bounds with hopes of better things, and I sincerely wish you may be able to support it at what you mention." It was one thing for Hamilton to employ the Bank of New York to prop up share prices, and quite another to enlist a longtime friend and grand-scale speculator as his intermediary. Dewar, of course, denied all wrongdoing. "Those who impute to my artifices the rise of the species of stock in the market beyond its true point of value do me infinite injustice," he pleaded. Hamilton's letter could only have emboldened Dewar to believe that he might profit from inside information, and he continued to flaunt his association with the Treasury Secretary, leading unsuspecting investors to believe he was privy to government plans. For the moment, Hamilton's actions halted the slide in financial markets and averted a catastrophic break in prices. Scrip fell back to a more reasonable 110 share price before rallying to 145 in September. For the first time in American history, Hamilton had demonstrated how a financial regulator could steady a panicky market through deft, behind-the-scenes operations. Unfortunately, he had erred in confiding in William Dewar, who remained deaf to Hamilton's admonition that he restrain his speculation. For Hamilton's growing legion of critics, the financial mayhem showed the corrosive effect of his financial wizardry. New York merchant Seth Johnson deplored the behavior induced by prodigal trading in bank shares. "Those who gain play in hope of more. Those who lose continue in hope of better fortune." For Jefferson, scripomania brought to the surface all his disgust for the Hamiltonian system, making imperative the need to preserve a pure agrarian America. "Ships are lying at the wharves," he wrote that summer. "Buildings are stopped. Capitals are withdrawn from commerce, manufactures, arts, and agriculture to be employed in gambling, and the tide of public prosperity, almost unparalleled in any country, is arrested in its course and suppressed by the rage of getting rich in one day." For Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton was more than just dead wrong in his prescriptions. He was becoming a menace to the American experiment, one who had to be stopped at all costs. Chapter 19, City of the Future. By the summer of 1791, after his victories in his skirmishes with Jefferson and Madison over public credit, assumption, and a central bank, Hamilton had attained the summit of his power. Such stellar success might have bred an intoxicating sense of invincibility, but his vigorous reign had also made him the enfant terrible of the early republic, and a substantial minority of the country was mobilized against him. This should have made him especially watchful of his reputation. Instead, in one of history's most mystifying cases of bad judgment, he entered into a sordid affair with a married woman named Maria Reynolds that, if it did not blacken his name forever, certainly sullied it. From the lofty heights of statesmanship, Hamilton fell back into something reminiscent of the squalid world of his West Indian boyhood. Philadelphia had its quota of sensual pleasures. Though French visitors dismissed it as quaintly puritanical, it enjoyed a livelier reputation among Americans. Hamilton and other government officials had access to a nocturnal medley of parties, balls, and plays. These social gatherings were often hosted by Federalist merchants. The queen bee of local society was Anne Willing Bingham, wife of the extremely rich William Bingham, who presided over banquets at their opulent three-story mansion near 3rd Street and Spruce. Far from being prim, Philadelphia gatherings in the 1790s abounded in exposed arms and bosoms, if Abigail Adams is to be trusted. She was shocked by all the female flesh on display at parties. The style of dress is really an outrage upon all decency. The arm naked almost to the shoulder and without stays or bodice. Most ladies wear their clothes too scant upon the body and too full upon the bosom, for my fancy. Not content with the show which nature bestows, they borrow from art and literally look like nursing mothers. The vivacious Alexander and Eliza Hamilton socialized with the Binghams and other affluent couples. Perhaps by that spring, Eliza had felt the strain of their social obligations and needed time to recuperate. In mid-May 1791, knowing that Hamilton was bogged down with work, Philip Schuyler begged Eliza and the four children, plus the orphaned Fanny Antill, to join him in Albany for the summer. To avoid epidemics, many people vacated Philadelphia and other large cities in sultry weather. "I fear if she remains where she is until the hot weather commences that her health may be much injured," Schuyler confided to Hamilton about Eliza. "Let me therefore entreat you to expedite her as soon as possible." So due to Schuyler's tender concern, Eliza and the children left Philadelphia soon after the sensational offering of bank scrip on July 4th and stayed away for the rest of that torrid summer. It was a dangerous moment for Eliza to abandon Hamilton. He was the cynosure of all eyes, and many people noted his enchantment with women. John Adams carped at his indelicate pleasures. Harrison Gray Otis told his wife of Hamilton's licorice flirtation with a married woman at a dinner party, and Benjamin Latrobe, later the surveyor of public buildings in Washington, branded him an insatiable libertine. Such descriptions, though hyperbolic, may have contained a grain of truth. Hamilton was susceptible to the charms of beautiful women. Like many people driven by their careers, he did not allow himself sufficient time for escape and relaxation. When Charles Wilson Peel painted him in 1791, Hamilton had the air of a commanding politician, his mouth firm, his eyes narrowed with concentration. No trace of joy softened his serious face. He was a volatile personality encased inside a regimented existence. Whenever he dealt with women, Hamilton shed his bureaucratic manner and reverted to the whimsy of bygone days. Right before the bank subscription, Hamilton received a volume of dramatic verse, The Ladies of Castile, from Mercy Warren, a Massachusetts poet, playwright, and historian. Hamilton sent a dashing note of thanks. "It is certain that in The Ladies of Castile, the sex will find a new occasion of triumph. Not being a poet myself, I am in the less danger of feeling mortification at the idea that, in the career of dramatic composition at least, female genius in the United States has outstripped the male." His wit with women was often flirtatious. When his friend Susanna Livingston inquired about treasury certificates she owned, Hamilton apologized for his delay in responding and said that he held himself bound by all the laws of chivalry to make the most ample reparation in any mode you shall prescribe. You will, of course, recollect that I am a married man. As the son of a fallen woman, Hamilton tended to be chivalric toward women in trouble. The day after he complimented Warren, he wrote to a Boston widow named Martha Walker, who had petitioned Congress for relief, contending that her husband had sacrificed valuable property in Quebec to enlist in the Revolution. With countless petitions coming before Congress, it is noteworthy that Hamilton plucked this one from the pile, assuring Walker that I shall enter upon the examination with every profession which can be inspired by favorable impression of personal merit and by a sympathetic participation in the distresses of a lady as deserving as unfortunate. These letters to Warren and Walker, written right before Eliza left for Albany, suggest that Hamilton was more than receptive to overtures from women. 6 years later, Alexander Hamilton found himself transported back to that summer of 1791 as he told a flabbergasted public about his extended sexual escapade with 23-year-old Mariah Reynolds, who must have been very alluring. She had arrived unannounced at his red brick house at 79 South 3rd Street. He began his famous account thus. Sometime in the summer of the year 1791, a woman called at my house in the city of Philadelphia and asked to speak with me in private. I attended her into a room apart from the family. Reynolds beguiled Hamilton with a doleful tale of a husband, James Reynolds, who for a long time had treated her very cruelly, and had lately left her to live with another woman, and in so destitute a condition that though desirous of returning to her friends, she had not the means. Since Mariah Reynolds came from New York and Hamilton was a New York citizen, Hamilton continued, she had taken the liberty to apply to my humanity for assistance. Her sudden listing in the 1791 city directory as the mysterious Mrs. Reynolds, she was virtually the only person to appear without a first name, seems to confirm her recent arrival in Philadelphia. The 36-year-old Hamilton never shrank from a maiden in distress, as Mariah Reynolds must have known. He told her that her situation was a very interesting one, and that he wished to assist her, but that she had come at an inopportune moment. That is, Eliza was at home. He volunteered to bring a small supply of money to her home at 154 South 4th Street that evening. Hamilton recounted that meeting with a certain novelistic flair. In the evening, I put a bank bill in my pocket and went to the house. I inquired for Mrs. Reynolds and was shown upstairs, at the head of which she met me and conducted me into a bedroom. I took the bill out of my pocket and gave it to her. Some conversation ensued from which it was quickly apparent that other than pecuniary consolation would be acceptable. That encounter was the first of many times that Alexander Hamilton slipped furtively through the night to see Reynolds. Once Eliza had gone off to Albany, the coast was clear to bring his mistress home. After their first rendezvous, Hamilton recalled, "I had frequent meetings with her, most of them at my own house." After a short period, Reynolds informed Hamilton of a sudden reconciliation with her husband, which Hamilton later claimed he had encouraged. But Mariah Reynolds was no ordinary adulteress, and politics now entered into the picture. She informed Hamilton that her husband had speculated in government securities and had even profited from information obtained from Treasury Department sources. When Hamilton met James Reynolds, the latter fingered William Duer as the source of this information. It is baffling that Hamilton, having worked to achieve a spotless reputation as Treasury Secretary, did not see that he was now courting danger and would be susceptible to blackmail. Mariah Reynolds introduced Hamilton to her husband as her benevolent, disinterested savior during a time of desperation, and for this James Reynolds feigned gratitude. But when Reynolds said that he was going to Virginia, he asked whether Hamilton could secure a government job for him upon his return. Hamilton remained noncommittal. In recollecting events, Hamilton admitted that the more he learned about the sleazy James Reynolds, the more he thought of ending the affair. He was in the midst of preparing his great report on manufactures, yet he was also in the grip of a dark sexual compulsion, and Mariah Reynolds knew how to hold him fast in her toils by feigning love. All the appearances of violent attachment and of agonizing distress at the idea of a relinquishment were played off with a most imposing art, he wrote. This, though it did not make me entirely the dupe of the plot, yet kept me in a state of irresolution. My sensibility, perhaps my vanity, admitted the possibility of a real fondness, and led me to adopt the plan of a gradual discontinuance rather than of a sudden interruption, at least calculated to give pain if a real partiality existed. As often is the case with addictions, the fanciful notion of a gradual discontinuance only provided a comforting pretext for more sustained indulgence. In his later pamphlet, Hamilton was at pains to suggest that Mariah Reynolds may have been sincerely smitten with him. His recounting of the affair suggests that at moments the relationship struck him as genuinely romantic. He could never make up his mind whether it had started honestly on her side and then turned to blackmail, or whether she had conspired with James Reynolds all along. Perhaps, as Hamilton intimated, his vanity could not admit that he had been conned by a pair of low-life tricksters. The man accused by his enemies of bottomless craft could be a most credulous dupe. Whenever his interest flagged, Mariah Reynolds regained his sympathy by telling him that her husband was abusing her, or, more pointedly, that he had threatened to spill the story to Eliza. For Hamilton, Mariah Reynolds always remained a curious amalgam of tragicomic figure and confidence woman. Whatever Mariah Reynolds' initial intentions, Hamilton must have seemed elegant, charming, and godlike compared to her vulgarian husband. It is hard to imagine that some genuine feeling for Hamilton did not enter sporadically into her emotions. She wrote him numerous letters. Hamilton ruefully called her a great scribbler, notable for atrocious grammar, spelling, and punctuation. Some letters seemed to consist of a single run-on sentence. In these missives, Mariah Reynolds portrayed herself as a wretched, lovelorn creature, desperate to see Hamilton again and pining away with loneliness. While such letters may have persuaded Hamilton that her emotions were sincere, their hysterical excesses should have alerted him that he was dealing with a perilously unstable woman. We know very little about the background of Mariah Reynolds. She was born Mary Lewis in Dutchess County, New York, in 1768, married James Reynolds at 15, and 2 years later gave birth to a daughter named Susan. At some point, she switched her name from Mary to Mariah. She told Hamilton that her sister Susanna had married Gilbert J. Livingston, which endowed her with respectable Hudson Valley connections. One Philadelphia merchant, Peter A. Grochin, described her as smart, sensitive, and genteel, but this picture conflicts with an affidavit from Richard Falwell, whose mother was her first landlady in Philadelphia. Falwell etched a portrait of Mariah Reynolds that tallies more closely with Hamilton's account of a mercurial personality prone to wild mood swings. Her mind at this time was far from being tranquil or consistent, for almost at the same minute that she would declare her respect for her husband, cry, and feel distressed, the tears would vanish and levity would succeed with bitter execrations on her husband. This inconsistency and folly was ascribed to a troubled but innocent and harmless mind. In one or other of these paroxysms, she told me, so infamous was the perfidy of Reynolds, that he had frequently enjoined and insisted that she should insinuate herself on certain high and influential characters, endeavor to make assignations with them, and actually prostitute herself to gull money from them. After leaving the Falwell residence, Mariah and James Reynolds lived on North Grant Street, where they occupied separate beds, or even rooms, while Mariah dabbled in prostitution. Gentlemen left letters in her entryway, Falwell said, and at night she would fly off, as was supposed, to answer their contents. Falwell's testimony confirms both the sincerity and patent insincerity of the mixed-up Mariah Reynolds. There seems little question that she approached Hamilton as part of an extortion racket, delivering an adept performance as a despairing woman. It was also clear, however, that she was too flighty to stick to any script. Since she despised her husband, she may have nourished fantasies that Hamilton would rescue her even as she preyed upon him. Fact and fiction may have blended imperceptibly in her mind. Hamilton later concluded of his paramour, the variety of shapes which this woman could assume was endless. Mariah Reynolds was the antithesis of the sturdy, sensible, loyal Eliza. The more depressing then to survey the letters Hamilton sent to Eliza that summer to keep her at bay. On August 2nd, he expressed satisfaction that she had arrived safely in Albany and showed concern, "Take good care of my lamb," for their 3-year-old son James, who was ill. At the same time, Hamilton pressed her to stay in Albany. I am so anxious for a perfect restoration of your health that I am willing to make a great sacrifice for it. At one point, when Eliza seemed about to return on short notice, Hamilton, worried that he might be taken by surprise, exhorted her to let me know beforehand your determination that I may meet you at New York. In late August, when her return seemed imminent, Hamilton advised that much as I long for this happy moment, my extreme anxiety for the restoration of your health will reconcile me to your staying longer where you are. Think of me, dream of me, and love me, my Betsy, as I do you. Finally, in September, with Hamilton suffering from his old kidney ailment and taking warm baths to soothe it, Eliza decided to return with the children. One last time, Hamilton urged her, don't alarm yourself nor hurry so as to injure either yourself or the children. It is easy to snicker at such deceit and conclude that Hamilton faked all emotion for his wife, but this would belie the otherwise exemplary nature of their marriage. Eliza Hamilton never expressed anything less than a worshipful attitude toward her husband. His love for her, in turn, was deep and constant, if highly imperfect. The problem was that no single woman could seem to satisfy all the needs of this complex man with his checkered childhood. As mirrored in his earliest adolescent poems, Hamilton seemed to need two distinct types of love: love of the faithful, domestic kind, and love of the more forbidden, exotic variety. In his later confessions, Hamilton tried to explain the mad persistence of this affair by citing his terror that James Reynolds might blurt out the truth to Eliza. As he phrased it, no man tender of the happiness of an excellent wife could, without extreme pain, look forward to the affliction which she might endure from the disclosure, especially a public disclosure of the fact. Those best acquainted with the interior of my domestic life will best appreciate the force of such a consideration upon me. The truth was that I dreaded extremely a disclosure, and was willing to make large sacrifices to avoid it. In the end, his desire to spare Eliza led him only to hurt her the more. When Eliza returned to Philadelphia that fall, Hamilton could no longer receive Mariah Reynolds at his residence and resorted to her home. The Hamiltons had by now moved to Market Street, near the presidential mansion. How he squeezed in time for these carnal interludes while compiling his report on manufactures is a wonder. That he inserted these trysts into such a tight schedule only strengthens the impression that Hamilton was ensnared by a sexual obsession. It was as if, after inhabiting a world of high culture for many years, Hamilton had regressed back to the sensual, dissolute world of his childhood. There is again a Dickensian quality to his story. The young hero escapes a tawdry life only to be lured back into it by a pair of unscrupulous swindlers. If Hamilton thought he could commit adultery without paying a penalty, he learned otherwise when James Reynolds materialized again late that fall. During the Revolution, Reynolds had worked as a skipper on a Hudson River sloop and supplied provisions to patriotic troops, meeting William Dewar and other purveyors. He then went to sea before settling in New York, and he had sought employment at the new Treasury Department in 1789. Though he wangled a reference letter from Robert Troop, he was rejected for a job, possibly giving him an extra motive for vengeance against Hamilton. The following year, some New York speculators sent Reynolds south to buy up claims that the government owed to veterans in Virginia and North Carolina. On December 15th, 1791, 10 days after Hamilton submitted his report on manufactures to Congress, his earlier charade of friendship with James Reynolds abruptly ended. One day I received a letter from Mariah Reynolds, intimating a discovery of the sexual liaison by her husband, Hamilton was to recall. It was a matter of doubt with me whether there had been really a discovery by accident, or whether the time for the catastrophe of the plot was arrived. James Reynolds displayed a sure sense of timing. The hubbub over the manufacturing report made it an ideal moment to threaten Hamilton, who was much in the newspapers. On the unforgettable afternoon of Thursday, December 15th, 1791, Mariah Reynolds warned Hamilton that her husband had written to him and that if he didn't receive a reply, he will write Mrs. Hamilton. Mariah, as usual, was overcome with emotion. Oh my God, I feel more for you than myself, and wish I had never been born to give you so much unhappiness. Do not write to him. No, not a line, but come here soon. Do not send or leave anything in his power, Mariah. Hamilton had indeed received a thinly veiled blackmail note from James Reynolds that began, I am very sorry to find out that I have been so cruelly treated by a person that I took to be my best friend, instead of that my greatest enemy. You have deprived me of everything that's near and dear to me. A master of crude melodrama, Reynolds told Hamilton that Mariah had been weeping constantly, that this had made him suspicious, and that he had trailed a black messenger who carried one of her letters to Hamilton's home. Upon confronting Mariah, the poor, broken-hearted woman had confessed to the affair. Here James Reynolds worked himself up into self-righteous wrath. Instead of being a friend, you have acted the part of the most cruelest man in existence. You have made a whole family miserable. She says there is no other man that she care for in this world. Now, sir, you have been the cause of cooling her affections for me. She was a woman. I should as soon suspect an angel from heaven, and one where all my happiness was depending. And I would sacrifice almost my life to make her happy. But now I am determined to have satisfaction. Hamilton summoned Reynolds to his office that afternoon. He did not know whether Reynolds had proof of the affair or was bluffing, so he played it cagey. He later wrote that he neither admitted nor denied the affair, telling Reynolds that if he knew of any injury I had done him, entitling him to satisfaction, it lay with him to name it. It was easy to understand that he wanted money, and to prevent an explosion, I resolved to gratify him. He withdrew with a promise of compliance. Hamilton was a rank amateur in adultery. By allowing James Reynolds to be seen in his office, he had given the blackmailer the upper hand. On Saturday evening, December 17th, James Reynolds wrote to Hamilton and charged him with alienating Mariah's affections. I find the wife always weeping and praying that I won't leave her, and it's all on your account, for if you had not seeked for her ruin, it would not have happened. Reynolds demanded some compensation for his ruined marriage and arranged to meet with Hamilton the next day. Hamilton was so alarmed that he sent a note to an unnamed correspondent stating, I am this moment going to a rendezvous which I suspect may involve a most serious plot against me. As any disastrous event might interest my fame, I drop you this line that from my impressions may be inferred the truth of the matter. At their meeting, Reynolds was very businesslike, and Hamilton asked him to name his price. The day after, Reynolds said that $1,000 would be a proper salve to his wounded honor. He contended that he could never regain his wife's love and that he planned to leave town with their daughter. Hamilton was forced to pay the now considerable blackmail money in installments, making one payment on December 22nd and a second on January 3rd. James Reynolds, if poor at spelling, was able to fathom Hamilton's insatiable sexual appetite for his wife and his dread of exposure. At this point, Hamilton tried to terminate the shabby affair, which formed such an odd counterpoint to the splendor of his public life. Briefly, he ceased all contact with Mariah. This frightened James Reynolds, who saw future income fast fading away. On January 17, 1792, he wrote to Hamilton and urged him to visit the house and regard his wife as a friend. Suddenly, he was no longer the wronged spouse, but a philanthropist concerned with his wife's welfare, not a grief-stricken husband, but a shameless pimp for his wife. It is hard to believe that at this juncture Hamilton did not abruptly end this hazardous affair. Of Reynolds' invitation, Hamilton wrote, If I recollect rightly, I did not immediately accept the invitation, nor till after I had received several very importunate letters from Mrs. Reynolds. Subsequent letters from husband and wife were a persevering scheme to spare no pains to levy contributions upon my passions on the one hand and upon my apprehensions of discovery on the other. Even as Hamilton had indulged his lust for Mariah Reynolds, his imagination was conjuring up a futuristic industrial city, a microcosm of the manufacturing society that he envisioned to counter Jefferson's nation of citizen farmers. At a time when 19 of 20 Americans tilled the soil, Hamilton feared that if America remained purely agrarian, it would be relegated to eternally subordinate status vis-à-vis European societies. It was already an age of scientific wonders that promised to reshape economies and boost productivity. From the first steam engine that James Watt built in Great Britain in the 1760s, to the hot air balloons that floated across French skies in the 1780s, to Eli Whitney's invention of the cotton gin and the use of interchangeable parts in the 1790s, it was a time of technological marvels. No industry was being transformed more dramatically than British textiles. Sir Richard Arkwright had devised a machine called the water frame that used the power of rushing water to spin many threads simultaneously. By the time Hamilton was sworn in as Treasury Secretary, Arkwright's mills on the Clyde in Scotland employed more than 1,300 hands. As much as the Bank of England, the British Exchequer, and the Royal Navy, these industrial breakthroughs had catapulted Britain to a leading position in the world economy. The British treated such economic discoveries as precious state secrets, which they guarded jealously against rival nations. Laws were passed to outlaw the export of textile machinery, and ships were stopped mid-ocean if they contained such contraband cargo. Skilled mechanics who worked in textile factories were forbidden to emigrate upon pain of fine and imprisonment, for even if they couldn't smuggle out blueprints, they could memorize methods and peddle this valuable information abroad. All of this Hamilton watched with rapt fascination. Certainly no other man in America saw so clearly the significance of the change that was taking place in English industrialism, Vernon Perrington wrote of Hamilton, and what tremendous reservoirs of wealth the new order laid open to the country that tapped them. The Treasury Secretary intuited that the future strength of nation-states would be proportionate to their industrial prowess, and he celebrated the early growth of American industry, whether it was entrepreneurs making wool hats or glass in Pennsylvania or watchmakers in Connecticut. Contrary to the image of Hamilton as a tool of England, Hamilton enlisted early on in a scheme to challenge British supremacy in textiles. In January 1789, investors crowded into Rawson's Tavern on Wall Street to feast on wine and cake and consecrate the New York Manufacturing Society. 2 months later, Hamilton's name appeared among charter subscribers investing in a new woolen factory scheduled to open on Crown Street, later Liberty Street, in Lower Manhattan. In the end, the facility suffered from a fatal shortage of water power and closed a year or two later, but the experience initiated Hamilton into the mysteries of the new industrial order. Around this time, a young man named Samuel Slater slipped through the tight protective net thrown by British authorities around their textile business. As a former apprentice to Sir Richard Arkwright, Slater had sworn that he would never reveal his boss's trade secrets. Flouting this pledge, he sailed to New York and made contact with Moses Brown, a Rhode Island Quaker. Under Slater's supervision, Brown financed a spinning mill in Rhode Island that replicated Arkwright's mill. Hamilton received detailed reports of this triumph, and pretty soon mill dams proliferated on New England's rivers. With patriotic pride, Brown predicted to Hamilton that mills and machines may be erected in different places in 1 year to make all the cotton yarn that may be wanted in the United States. Hamilton's policies were consistent with the drive for autarky and trade on equal terms with England that had fired the American Revolution in the first place. The colonists had rebelled against an imperial system that restricted their manufactures and forced them to hawk their raw materials to the mother country, stifling their economic potential. Before the Revolution, England had imposed a law banning the export to America of any tools that might assist in the manufacture of cotton, linen, wool, and silk. The British manufacturers of hats, nails, steel, and gunpowder had impeded American efforts to make comparable articles. It was Hamilton's vision of America as a manufacturing behemoth, not Jefferson's of a society of yeoman farmers, that threatened the British. The shape of Hamilton's future industrial policy was foreshadowed in May 1790 when Tench Coxe replaced William Dewar as Assistant Treasury Secretary. The move possessed vast symbolic meaning, for Coxe was a well-known advocate of manufacturing and eager to raid Britain's industrial secrets. That February, he had written a long letter to Hamilton, praising America's maiden efforts at industry, but citing a shortage of both capitalists and large-scale capital as retarding the introduction of labor-saving machinery. He regretted that because of Britain's pugnacious defense of her technological superiority in textiles, the United States was not yet in full possession of workmen, machines, and secrets in the useful arts. Hamilton and Cox teamed up in a daring assault on British industrial secrets. Cox decided that the best way to achieve industrial parity with England was to woo knowledgeable British textile managers to America, even if this meant defying English law. Right before joining Treasury, he posted a man named Andrew Mitchell to England to snoop around factories and surreptitiously make models of textile machinery. Additionally, on January 11, 1790, Cox had signed an agreement with a British weaver, George Parkinson, who also had studied at Arkwright's feet, and bragged openly that he possessed the knowledge of all the secret movements used in Sir Richard Arkwright's patented machine. In exchange for passage to Philadelphia, Parkinson agreed to provide Cox with a working model of a flax mill that incorporated Arkwright's designs. On March 24, 1791, the U.S. government granted patents for Parkinson's flax mill, even though he had admitted that they were improvements upon the mill or machinery in Great Britain. Clearly, the U.S. government condoned something that, in modern phraseology, could be termed industrial espionage. Building upon this precedent, Hamilton put the full authority of the Treasury behind the piracy of British trade secrets. By April 1791, Hamilton had lent his prestige to Cox's plan for a manufacturing society operated by private interests that would enjoy the general blessings of government. It would be a pilot project, a laboratory for innovation. The Society for Establishing Useful Manufactures, SEUM, was lauded by a later historian as the most ambitious industrial experiment in early American history. It was almost certainly Hamilton, with an assist from Cox, who wrote the eloquent prospectus for the Society that appeared on April 29th. He left no doubt as to how he envisaged America's future, writing that both theory and experiences conspire to prove that a nation cannot possess much active wealth but as a result of extensive manufactures. The Society intended to create more than a single mill. It projected an entire manufacturing town, with investors profiting from the factory's products and the appreciation of the underlying real estate. The prospectus listed a cornucopia of goods, including paper, sailcloth, cottons and linens, women's shoes, thread, worsted stockings, hats, ribbons, blankets, carpets, and beer that the Society might manufacture. Hamilton hoped that through the spirit of imitation, the Society would spawn comparable domestic businesses. Thus far, the major hindrance to such enterprise had been slender resources, but lack of capital had now been remedied by the government's funded debt. Once again, Hamilton used one program to advance the fortunes of another in an ever-expanding web of economic activity. The Society needed $500,000 in seed capital, and the prospectus pointed out that it could be paid for partly in government bonds, promoting public debt and the industrial city at one stroke. "Here is the resource which has been hitherto wanted," Hamilton boasted. That Hamilton was prepared to ransack European industrial secrets was made plain when the prospectus said that means ought to be taken to procure from Europe skillful workmen and such machines and implements as cannot be had here in sufficient perfection. Hamilton did not lend his prestige to the scheme from afar. In July 1791, the same month investors gobbled up bank scrip and he began his dalliance with Maria Reynolds, he traveled to New York to drum up support for the Society's first stock offering, which sold out instantly. He then attended the subscribers' inaugural meeting in New Brunswick, New Jersey, in August. In choosing directors later that year, Hamilton blundered by turning to his freewheeling companion, the speculator William Dewar. He packed the board with local financiers, 7 directors from New York, 6 from New Jersey, instead of striving for broad geographic representation. The board was also excessively crammed with financiers when men with industrial credentials were sorely needed. Early on, Hamilton and Cox settled on New Jersey as the optimal place for this venture. The state was densely populated, possessed cheap land and abundant forests, and enjoyed easy access to New York money. Most critically, it was well watered by rivers that could spin turbine blades and water wheels. That August, Hamilton dispatched scouts to investigate these waterways. He and other Society members were swamped with appeals from local landlords touting the wonders of their riverside properties. It was later on concluded, largely at Dewar's insistence, that the Great Falls of the Passaic in northern New Jersey offered one of the finest situations in the world. Hamilton knew the secluded spot well. One day during the Revolution, he, Washington, and Lafayette had picnicked by the falls, enjoying a modest repast of cold ham, tongue, and biscuits in a sylvan setting that momentarily banished thoughts of war. The Great Falls mark a scenic bend in the Passaic River, the foaming water, up to 2 billion gallons per day, plunging 70 feet into a deep, narrow gorge of brownish-black basalt, blowing a rainbow-forming spray into the air. The society decided to call the new town Patterson to flatter Governor William Patterson. On November 22, 1791, the governor returned the favor, granting the society a charter, likely written by Hamilton, that gave it monopoly status and a 10-year tax exemption. The society bought 700 acres and carved it up into parcels, not just for factories, but for a brand new town, one that became the third largest city in New Jersey. Incredibly, Hamilton, with his ever-growing roster of projects, personally recruited supervisors for the first cotton spinning mill. This glorified advisor hired as foreman the same George Parkinson who had plundered British secrets for flax spinning machinery. The Treasury subsidized Parkinson's living expenses. In July, Hamilton had received an extraordinary letter from another renegade employee of Sir Richard Arkwright, Thomas Marshall, who also came to America armed with British textile secrets. Having been superintendent at Arkwright's huge Derbyshire mill, he bragged to Hamilton that he had toured the mill again on a reconnaissance mission the previous fall. "I was all over his works and am consequently fully acquainted with every modern improvement." Marshall had no misgivings about snatching English mechanics for the Society's projects and suggested that a master of his business in the weaving branch and in possession of all or most of the fashionable patterns now worn in England will be very useful. That August, Hamilton negotiated contract after contract with British textile refugees, including William Hall, who had learned to stain and bleach fabrics, and William Pierce, who had erected a Yorkshire cotton mill. That December, when the Society's board met to consider personnel for the new operation, it rubber-stamped all of Hamilton's choices. Hamilton wasn't content just to demonstrate the practicality of American manufacturing on a New Jersey riverbank. He felt compelled to make the theoretical case, which he did in his classic Report on Manufactures, submitted to Congress on December 5, 1791. The capstone of his ambitious state papers, it had fermented in his brain for some time. Nearly 2 years earlier, the House had asked him to prepare a report on how America might promote manufacturing. Hamilton now generated a full-blown vision of the many ways that the federal government could invigorate such economic activity. The report was the first government-sponsored plan for selective industrial planning in America, the tract in which, in the words of one Hamilton chronicler, he prophesied much of post-Civil War America. The impetus for the report had been largely military and strategic in nature. Washington had admonished Congress that a free people ought to promote such manufactories as tend to render them independent of others for essential, particularly for military, supplies. Remembering the scarcity of everything from gunpowder to uniforms in the Continental Army, a byproduct of Britain's colonial monopoly on most manufacturing, Hamilton knew that reliance on foreign manufacturers could cripple America in wartime. The extreme embarrassments of the United States during the late war, from an incapacity of supplying themselves, are still matter of keen recollection, he noted in the report. To prepare for this study, the indefatigable Hamilton canvassed manufacturers and revenue collectors, quizzing them in detail about the state of production in their districts. As usual, he aspired to know everything: the number of factories in each district, the volume of goods produced, their prices and quality, the spurs and checks to production provided by state governments. To obtain a first-hand feel for American wares, he even wanted to touch them, to feel them. "It would also be acceptable to me," he told revenue supervisors, "to have samples in cases in which it could be done with convenience and without expense." As he accumulated swatches, wool from Connecticut, carpets from Massachusetts, Hamilton, with a flair for showmanship, laid them out in the committee room of the House of Representatives as if operating a small trade fair, an altogether new form of lobbying. Hamilton's previous state papers had been purely the coinage of his own mind. He never employed ghostwriters, whereas he received critical assistance on the report on manufacturers from Tench Cox, who had drafted an early sketch urging American self-sufficiency in gunpowder, brass, iron, and other items. Eventually, Hamilton came to regard Cox as a conceited, devious fellow who overrated his own talents. He later said, "That man is too cunning to be wise. I have been so much in the habit of seeing him mistaken that I hold his opinion cheap." But at this juncture, Cox's expertise was vital. Hamilton revised and elaborated Cox's preliminary paper. He embroidered Cox's proposals with esoteric economic theory and an assertive vision of American political might through manufacturing. Far more than just a technical document, the report on manufacturers was a prescient statement of American nationalism. In his advocacy of manufacturing, Hamilton knew that he would encounter stout resistance from those who feared that factories might hurt agriculture and menace Republican government. His opponents cited abundant land and deficient capital and labor as reasons that America should remain a rural democracy. Jefferson, in particular, foresaw an enduring equation between American democracy and agriculture. Shortly before returning from France, he wrote that circumstances rendered it impossible that America should become a manufacturing country during the time of any man now living. From the outset, Hamilton emphasized that he was not scheming to replace farms with factories, and that agriculture had intrinsically a strong claim to preeminence over every other kind of industry. Far from wishing to harm agriculture, manufacturing would create domestic markets for surplus crops. All that he recommended was that farming not have an exclusive predilection. Since manufacturing and agriculture obeyed different economic cycles, a downturn in one could be offset by an upturn in another. Throughout the report, he contested the influence of the physiocrats, the school of French economists that extolled agriculture as the most productive form of human labor and condemned government attempts to steer the economy. Hamilton refuted their belief that agriculture was inherently productive while manufacturing was barren and unproductive. Displaying an intimate familiarity with Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, Hamilton demonstrated that manufacturing, no less than agriculture, could increase productivity because it subdivided work into ever simpler operations and lent itself to mechanization. He also insisted that America's focus on agriculture was not just a natural byproduct of geography, but had been foisted on the country by European trading practices. Hamilton evoked a thriving future economy that bore scant resemblance to the static, stratified society his enemies claimed he wanted to impose. His America would be a meritocracy of infinite variety, with a diversified marketplace absorbing people from all nations and backgrounds. Though slavery is nowhere mentioned in the report, Hamilton's ideal economy is devoid of the feudal barbarities of the southern plantations. Hamilton's list of the advantages of manufacturing has a quintessentially American ring. Additional employment to classes of the community not ordinarily engaged in the business. The promoting of emigration from foreign countries. The furnishing greater scope for the diversity of talents and dispositions which discriminate men from each other. The affording a more ample and various field for enterprise. Manufacturers and laborers would flock to a country rich in raw materials and favored with low taxes, running streams, thick forests, and a democratic government. And that influx of workers would eliminate one of the most pressing obstacles to American manufacturing, high wages. While Hamilton's emphasis on diversity may please modern ears, his stress on child labor is more jarring. Of the productive British cotton mills, he commented, "It is worthy of particular remark that, in general, women and children are rendered more useful, and the latter more early useful, by manufacturing establishments than they would otherwise be." In Britain's cotton mills, it was computed that 4/7 nearly are women and children, of whom the greatest proportion are children, and many of them of a very tender age. Hamilton's approval of this may sound callous, and it is certainly fair to fault him for not foreseeing the brutality of 19th-century mills. On the other hand, child labor in farms and workshops was then commonplace. Hamilton himself had started clerking in his early teens, and his mother had worked. Hamilton didn't see himself as inflicting grim retribution upon the indigent so much as giving them a chance to earn decent wages. For Hamilton, a job could be an ennobling experience. When all the different kinds of industry obtain in a community, each individual can find his proper element and can call into activity the whole vigor of his nature. Hamilton did not equate child or female labor with exploitation. In the best of all possible worlds, Hamilton preferred free trade, open markets, and Adam Smith's invisible hand. He wrote late in life, "In matters of industry, human enterprise ought doubtless to be left free in the main, not fettered by too much regulation, but practical politicians know that it may be beneficially stimulated by prudent aids and encouragements on the part of the government." At this early stage of American history, Hamilton thought aggressive European trade policies obligated the United States to respond in kind. He therefore supported temporary mercantilist policies that would improve American self-sufficiency, leading to a favorable trade balance and more hard currency. For a young nation struggling to find its way in a world of advanced European powers, realpolitik trumped the laissez-faire purism of Adam Smith. Reluctant to tinker with markets, Hamilton knew that he had to present a cogent brief for any government direction of investment. There was an obvious objection. Wouldn't smart entrepreneurs spot profitable opportunities and invest capital without bureaucratic prompting? Yes, Hamilton agreed, entrepreneurs react to market shifts, but for psychological reasons they sometimes responded at a sluggish pace. "These," he wrote, "have relation to the strong influence of habit and the spirit of imitation, the fear of want of success in untried enterprises, the intrinsic difficulties incident to first essays toward a competition with those who have already attained to perfection in the business to be attempted." Young nations had to contend with the handicap that other countries had already staked out entrenched positions. Infant industries needed the extraordinary aid and protection of government. Since foreign governments plied their companies with subsidies, America had no choice but to meet the competition. After doing the intellectual spade work for government promotion of manufacturers, Hamilton listed all the products he wanted to promote, ranging from copper to coal, wood to grain, silk to glass. He also enumerated policies, including premiums, bounties, and import duties, to protect these infant industries. Wherever possible, Hamilton preferred financial incentives to government directives. For instance, knowing that tariffs taxed consumers and handed monopoly profits to producers, Hamilton wanted them to be moderate in scale, temporary in nature, and repealed as soon as possible. He preferred bounties because they didn't raise prices. In some cases, he even wanted lower tariffs, on raw materials, for instance, to encourage manufacturing. And to speed innovation, he wanted to extend patent protection to inventors and adopt the sort of self-protective laws that Britain had used to try to hinder the export of innovative machinery. For Hamilton, the federal government had a right to stimulate business and also, when necessary, to restrain it. As Arthur Schlesinger Jr. has observed, Hamilton's enthusiasm over the dynamics of individual acquisition was always tempered by a belief in government regulation and control. In arguing, for instance, that government inspection of manufactured articles could reassure consumers and galvanize sales, he anticipated regulatory policies that were not enacted until the Progressive Era under Theodore Roosevelt. Contributing to prevent fraud upon consumers at home and exporters to foreign countries, to improve the quality and preserve the character of the national manufacturers, it cannot fail to aid the expeditious and advantageous sale of them and to serve as a guard against successful competition from other quarters. He also recommended that the government inspect flour exports at all ports, to improve the quality of our flour everywhere and to raise its reputation in foreign markets. Endorsing still another form of government activism, Hamilton claimed that nothing had assisted Britain's industry more than its network of public roads and canals. He therefore touted internal improvements, what we would today call public infrastructure, to meld America's scattered regional markets into a single, unified economy. Even though he devoted only two skimpy paragraphs to the manufacture of gunpowder, Hamilton never lost sight that his report on manufactures was initially driven by the need for self-sufficiency in arms. Determined not to be caught short-handed in case of war, Hamilton supported an annual purchase of military weapons to aid the formation of arsenals. So vital were supplies to national security that Hamilton did not rule out government-owned arms factories. In closing, Hamilton made clear that the energetic programs he described were not suited to all countries at all times, but were devised for an early stage of national development. In countries where there is great private wealth, much may be affected by the voluntary contributions of patriotic individuals. But in a community situated like that of the United States, the public purse must supply the deficiency of private resources. Hamilton's report on manufactures ultimately came to naught. End of Disc 15.